This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
There's a lot of virus and vaccine headlines. We've got, you know, Tim, I keep looking at some of the stuff going on overseas. I mean, Germany's thinking about spreading out the time between their first and second doses of vaccine shots because they're trying to speed up the vaccination drive there.
And I'm looking closer to home in Michigan, where we're seeing the country's worst outbreak right now. And earlier this week, Carol, this is startling. The state said that more than half, or just about half, of the folks who were in the hospital were under the age of 60. So starting to see younger patients have to be hospitalized.
Yeah, it's really rough to see kind of how the demographics have changed. Hey, let's get into it. We have a perfect guest to talk about the pandemic. Dr. Caitlin Rivers, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, infectious disease epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, supported, of course, by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. She joins us on the phone in Baltimore. Dr. Rivers, so nice to have you here on Bloomberg Radio. Your research that you've done is all about getting the public ready and dealing with responses when it comes to outbreak science and infectious diseases. So when you look at this so far, do you feel like at this point we're doing a better job?
We are definitely in a much better place than we were over the winter. Over the early in the year, we had about 250,000 cases reported each day. Lately, it's been more like 70,000 cases each day. So we have made a lot of progress, but we still have a long way to go. And I think it's important that we stay the course while we continue to get the pandemic under control.
And Carol mentioned some headlines from overseas. I'm talking about the United States and what we're seeing in Michigan and how it has become the worst hotspot in the nation. How is that happening? Well, vaccinations are on pace at a pretty good clip.
Yeah, it's true. Reopening, I think, does contribute. As people are doing more activities in the community, they're having more opportunity to be exposed, to come into contact with people who may be infected. I think the new variants are also playing a role. There is quite a lot of B.1.1.7, which is a variant first identified in the United Kingdom that passes more easily between people. There's quite a lot of that variant in Michigan, and I think it's working against us. But the good news is that every day that we continue on the vaccination campaign, the closer we get to having things under control. And so we've heard over and over again that it's a race between the vaccines and the variants, but I think it really is true.
Does it seem like from all the data that we've received so far, and this is like a, you know, this is the world's biggest science experiment that we've seen play out in real time. That's how I'm thinking about this. Do we see the variants holding their own against the vaccine or the vaccines holding their own against the variants? Does it depend on which vaccine you're getting? Like, what is the latest when it comes to how good these vaccines work against the variants that we're seeing?
Sure. There are two variants circulating in very low numbers that are not as quite of a good of a match for the vaccines, but they are still very effective. I think that's a bit of good news. At one point, we were worried that it would be a worse match than we end up seeing. And so the good news is the vaccines are still very effective against the variants. Now, over the long term, I do think we need to continue to look for even new variants and so that we're ready to update the vaccines if we need it. But thankfully, right now, that's not necessary.
But this is all about a race against those variants. That's what it comes down to at this point, right?
Yeah, that's right. The variant that spreads more easily between people, it makes it harder to get things under control using the same measures that we have been using for the whole pandemic. So masking has to be even better. Social distancing has to be even better in order to really match up against these new variants. But again, the vaccines work very well against the variants. And so I think overall, we will overcome. It's just we're in a bit of a bumpy patch right now.
But what do we also have to do when we look around and see the differences in terms of vaccine rollout around the world? Does it also say to you that until either we have vaccine passports or something so that we can control people coming into the country? I mean, what is it that you would recommend right now?
Yeah, vaccinating the world is absolutely top priority. As long as there is virus circulating in the world, there will be opportunity for new variants to arrive. We are doing very well with our vaccination campaign in the United States. 110 million people have already received their first dose. But that is not true in most of the world. Most places are just getting started. And so I think the more we can do to extend vaccines to really corner of the globe, the safer we'll be here at home.
What does that look like, though? I mean, it took us decades to eradicate polio, and I don't anticipate that we're going to eradicate COVID. It's going to become endemic. It's not going to be eradicated. That's what we've been hearing from scientists. But how does this happen around the world if this is going so slowly? And even in the United States, we're still months away from reaching 75% immunity.
It's true. We have quite a lot ahead of us, and I do think that it will be a longer time horizon than what we're facing here in the U.S. But we have done amazing things in public health. We've overcome great challenges. We've eradicated smallpox. We've driven several other diseases nearly to eradication. Even if that's not a goal on the table for COVID, I think it does speak to the enormous things we can accomplish when we put our minds to it. And I think this is absolutely one of those times when we need to commit to making it happen.
All right, we're going to come back and continue the conversation with Dr. Caitlin Rivers. She is senior scholar over at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. She's an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg. So looking forward to continuing the conversation. Because, Tim, one of the things I do think about is, you know, preparing for the next go-round. Because so many people have come on and said a few hundred million dollars. I mean, and if you think about, in contrast to the economic impact that we've seen, that's been trillions of dollars and counting, to make sure that we are ahead and ready for the next viruses that impact us.
Yeah, not just here in the United States, but a coordinated worldwide effort. I mean, we saw from the beginning that this virus doesn't care about borders. It doesn't care what country you're from. So it needs to be a coordinated global response. Let's get right back to you, Dr. Caitlin Rivers, senior scholar and infectious disease epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, joining us now on the phone from Baltimore. Dr. Rivers, we talked earlier about changes that the New York City School District is making because previously it had determined that two cases in a school would close that school. Now it's moving that to four. But it got us thinking about what the fall looks like and thinking about what parents and families have had to deal with over this last 13, 14 months. It has been really, really difficult for so many. What's a realistic expectation, do you think, based on the rate that we're going with vaccinations, the vaccination options that could be available for kids over the summer or into the fall, how parents should be thinking about school in a few months?
Yeah, of course. I do expect that as the fraction of the population that is vaccinated goes up, that cases will go down. And so we'll have a lot less virus circulating in the country, and that will make holding in-person learning a lot easier. The other thing that will be helpful is I do expect the vaccines will be available to younger children, probably over the summer. That may extend to children ages 12 to 16 who are not currently eligible, but likely will be soon. So high school and middle school will have the opportunity to get vaccinated. Elementary school students, however, we're looking more at 2022 before a vaccine becomes available. And so I think it's important that we keep mitigation measures in school through the fall, but I do expect that it will look a lot more like normal with full-time in-person learning.
Yay! I'm just going to say. Hey, listen, one thing I want to ask you about, and you shared some notes with us about the importance of developing a genomic surveillance strategy. You put those words together, and I know there's a bunch of listeners saying, well, wait a minute, tell me what exactly this means. What am I giving up in order for this to happen? Talk us through this.
Genomic surveillance is looking at people who test, looking at the viral specimens of people who test positive. So the little swab that goes in your nose to see whether you have COVID. Some of that can be tested and sequenced to look for new variants. The reason this is important is because some of the new variants we have seen crop up around the world are a little more worrisome. They spread more easily between people, or they may make our vaccines and therapeutics less effective. And so it's really important that we have a handle on what new variants are arising and how they're circulating. The UK does this very well, and that was how they were able to identify that they had a variant that was more transmissible.
Is this something that we need to put into place on a policy level that is going to be permanent?
We already have genomic surveillance for influenza, and so this is something that we already do frequently in public health. I do think we will have a permanent infrastructure for SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. And in fact, there was over $1.7 billion in the American Rescue Plan to put in place that surveillance. So that will be underway.
You know, Dr. Caitlin Rivers, we certainly have done this, I think Tim and I, when it comes to the business world, the market world, there are certain things that have changed us. You know, whether it was the financial crisis and other things that we've witnessed that has changed policy, that has changed the way we look at certain financial moves or certain companies. in terms of the pandemic, how has it changed how you look at the world? You're an epidemiologist. This is your world. How has it changed how you look at the future?
What I would like to see come out of this is a recognition that we can't afford not to be prepared. To date, it is usually an argument of whether or not we can afford preparedness. Should we spend money on it? And I think it's excruciatingly clear now that the opposite is true. We can't afford not to. And so I would like that to, I would like to see that come to be a bigger priority for us, both in the United States and around the world. We cannot afford another COVID-19, and it's up to us to make sure that we have in place the infrastructure to make sure this never happens to us again.
What's the most important piece of infrastructure to ensure that it never happens again?
One thing I'm excited about is a National Center for Epidemics Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics. This would be like the National Weather Service, but for outbreaks. The good news is that the Biden administration has announced that this center, forecasting center, will be created, and there was money for it in the American Rescue Plan. And so this is something we'll be getting, and I think that's going to be really important for improving our capabilities.
That's wild. So in other words, like a storm is coming. In other words, this would be an early indicator of there's maybe a virus we need to be worried about. Just got about 20 seconds here.
Yeah, early indicator, but also just looking around the corner. What's happening 2 weeks, 4 weeks from now? That can be very useful as well.
Very interesting stuff. Dr. Rivers, thank you so much. Dr. Caitlin Rivers, Senior Scholar and Infectious Disease Epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the Bloomberg Business Week cover story this week, which already feels like the biggest Wall Street story of the year. Tim, it's about the greatest trader you've never heard of, but who then went on to lose $20 billion.
Yeah, an absolutely massive fortune. It has stayed atop the most read on the Bloomberg terminal all day. Joel Weber is editor at Bloomberg Business Week, and he joins us on the access line from Brooklyn. Sri Natarajan is finance reporter at Bloomberg News and joins us on the phone from New York City. Sri, one of the folks who wrote about Bill Wong for the Bloomberg Business Week cover story this week. Joel, why so much interest in someone who before 10 days ago, most people, even many on Wall Street, had never heard of?
I think you answered part of the question there, which no one had ever heard of this guy before. Before Bloomberg's coverage over the last few days and weeks. I think it's just truly like this curiosity, like no one had ever heard of him. No one knew that he had this much wealth. And then the fact that it disappeared in just a matter of days, I think has just captivated everyone. And that was what, it set us on this path to do this story in this week's issue. And it really began with Sri's coverage. Eric Schatzker and Kathy Burton were the co-writers on it. And when we all started talking about it over the holiday weekend, we were just like, we have to put this all into a big story and put a bow on it. And then we did that. And Sri, bless him, just came through with some amazing details. So Sri, what were the big things you learned, not only just doing the overall coverage, but especially just for this particular cover story?
I think one thing to look at, and that goes back to Tim's question, right? Why do we care about him so much if no one really knew about him 10 days ago? The incredible aspect of this story is, forget the second leg of his career, forget what happened with the blow-up of this investment firm. Just the fact that he was able to parlay more than $200 million of initial funds in his family office, Archegos, and translated to over $20 billion in just 7 or 8 years. That is a remarkable story by itself. That is near 100 times returns. That is not usual, and that is why we call him the greatest trader you've never heard of. But then what follows is even more astonishing. You've had a situation where in a matter of days, all that wealth goes up in smoke because these were big wagers he's made in companies he believed in, with increasing amount of borrowed money from banks. And when those bets went against him, the banks moved to make sure that they didn't lose their skin. And in the process, his capital went up in smoke.
I think one of the biggest surprises that came out of all of this is his commitment to God. and the role of that in his life. Sri, talk to us about that and some of the things you found out.
Oh, that's just the other aspect of it that makes this such a remarkable tale to tell. When you think of a successful hedge fund trader, someone who runs a big firm, you can put all sorts of stereotypes on them, and almost everyone will fit one of the buckets. Bill Huang cannot be confined to any one of those. He's not your standard hedge fund flashy lifestyle person. He's not one that is playing a big role in on like setting the national political agenda. This is someone who came from really humble means. His father was a pastor in Korea. They moved to Las Vegas. Father died within a few months of being posted to a Vegas church, but his widowed mother took care of him after that, put him through college and MBA, but she went on to become a missionary in Mexico. His brother went on to become a missionary in Tijuana, Mexico, and Bill Huang really saw himself as a missionary with means. He was on Wall Street. He had the money, but he believed that all of that was to be put to use to spread the word of the gospel. And, you know, some people would say, wait, is that just a cover to, you know, we don't quite understand how is that possible. But in the last 2 weeks, the number of people we've spoken to who've known him well, who work with him, who work with him even now, they insist this is who he is. That's his life. And as much as all of us are animated by what has happened, the equally astonishing thing for me has been everyone who knows him tells us, you know, despite everything that's going on, he has not changed one bit. He's the same Bill Huang today as he was yesterday. And I just find even that aspect to be quite remarkable.
Okay, Sri, as fascinating as the God aspect and the religion aspect and everything is, like I ultimately told you, it's the thing that people are going to care about here is the money. And how do you lose $20 billion in 2 days exactly?
Well, let's start with saying that it's not easy to do that. You could try very hard, but most people will not be able to pull it off. But when you peel back the portfolio and you say, again, we still don't have the complete picture. We're piecing this together from multiple conversations we've had with bankers and other people in the industry and people who knew and know how Archegos operated to understand what might have happened. But just a simple way to look at it is, if he had $20, he would go borrow another $80 from a bank, which in this case, many banks across Wall Street and elsewhere were eager to give him that kind of leverage. You suddenly have $100 of capital to bet on a share like Viacom. While the shares are going up, a Viacom share that goes up from, say, $100 to $150, suddenly your own personal wealth, if you just look at the math behind it, goes from $20 to $70 because everything else is borrowed money. But that's, you know, more than tripling of your assets, even though the underlying stock is up only 50%. But that's what happened. He was making right bets. His capital was growing. He was plowing it back into the same bets because that was his level of conviction in the stocks that he picked out, his belief that those were valuable investments and he's going to stick with it come what may. Then when it moved the other way, that's the risk of leverage.
It's fascinating. Listen, it's something we have just been focusing on the last week and a half, and with good reason. Great, incredible reporting. Sri, thank you so much. Sri Natarajan, finance reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from New York City. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. This is the cover story of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. And listen, there's more in there. A quote from his mom, Wang's mom, about a fine he paid, millions of dollars, and also a Cathie Wood connection.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Remember Tom's?
You know what?
Are you wearing Tom's?
I'm not wearing Tom's, but that is the exact same thing I thought of when I read this recent piece from Jordan Holman.
What's that?
Yeah, whatever happened to Tom's?
Well, listen, and especially if you think about when we talked about give back companies, these were, Tom's was one of the first, I feel like, or if not the first, in terms of buy one and then somebody gets something in return.
These were all the rage in my 20s, the early 2010s. Yeah. Really? I mean, this is what people were wearing, and the buy one, get give one model was really innovative at the time.
Yeah, well, it's now itching for a comeback, the company. Let's get the story from Jordan Holman. She's Bloomberg News retail reporter, and she joins us on the phone in Atlanta. Jordan, I mean, it's so true. For a while, you know, a few years back, everybody knew about Tom's. Everybody bought Tom's. And then they just fell off everybody's radar.
Yeah, exactly. I also wore Tom's to, like, college tailgates and all that kind of stuff. But so what happened with Tom's is, you know, they had this huge rise. They were on everyone's radar. They really won over that millennial customer. But as it moved into, like, the mid-2010s, they had a majority stake from Bain. And, you know, the private equity money, things started going off the rails. They didn't capture the newest generation of teenagers, which are really important for any retailer to continue to thrive.
Hmm. What happened? What did they miss? What were the signs that they missed with the, sort of the next generation of consumers? Because, look, sneakers are hot. Footwear is hot right now. And Tom's just doesn't seem like they were able to hit that trend.
Yeah, I talked about this with their current CEO, who said that, you know, 5 years ago, they did really miss that sneaker trend that happened. Basically, all the shoes that we were wearing started to get sneakerized, either for comfortability or just for style. And Tom's, with that classic shoe that we're all probably talking about, that Alpargata, it didn't capture that, what was in the market at the moment. And then also, when we're thinking about Tom's, one of the big thing was their one-to-one model. So every time you bought a shoe, they said that they were donating a shoe to a needy kid, often overseas, outside of the U.S. Well, now, as part of their new business model, they're saying, we're getting rid of that, and we're just going to donate a third of our profits to different causes. And it's going to be a lot of causes that today's teenagers care about, such as mental health awareness or gun violence.
Do you blame private equity? Or not you, maybe, but do folks who look at the company and what happened blame private equity for what happened?
Well, if you look just at the numbers of the valuation of Tom's with that private equity, in 2014, Tom's was valued at about $625 million. Last year, in 2020, Tom's had sales north of $200 million. Hmm. Obviously, there was a lot happening last year for reasons of why people, you know, weren't buying as many shoes. But it does lead to the question of, like, was this mismanaged? Was this brand mismanaged in a way where they couldn't continue to grow? And did they miss some really key trends in this footwear market? Because they definitely captured the cultural imagination for a period of time.
What about the charity model? This, you know, buy one, you know, give one away, this one-for-one model. Is it a sign that it's hard to keep that financially sustainable?
So the company says that their change to the one-third of profits going to charity is equivalent, is financially equivalent to giving away a pair of shoes for every time someone buys one. But it does allow them more flexibility in the causes that they're supporting, so they don't have to just be tied to giving shoes away. But if you think about it in the long term, if it's tied to your profit, then that's better just for a business model.
Jordan, how are they thinking about those causes in the context of their customers and their future customers, like the ability to actually donate that one-third of profits to causes that the customers find important to them?
Yeah, so when you're thinking about Tom's, they really want to win over Generation Z. So that's today's teenagers and young adults, people in college. And those customers are different than millennials. They're actually very much more sustainability focused and want to make sure that their brands align with the causes that they care about. So what Tom's is doing is it's changing its marketing strategy. It's going to be less models and more people, like real people and advocates for the causes that they care about wearing the shoes. So then for customers, you know, maybe they will see this prominent activist also wearing Tom's or someone their age wearing Tom's, and maybe that will spark something for them to buy and then to be like, great, buy this. It also supports what I care about.
But it is kind of interesting that, you know, we talk a lot about people saying, you know, I'm going to shop from people or companies that stand for the same things I do or are for a cause, you know, kind of stick their head out and support causes. But it also shows that people will do that, Jordan, but they also want a shoe that they like, or at least in this instance, right? They want a product that they like. Just got about 30 seconds here.
Absolutely. It all comes down to, is the shoe comfortable? And that's what people are going to open up their wallets for. And so that's also Tom's thing. They have to compete in a very competitive footwear market that's only getting more competitive with the Nikes and Adidas's of the world.
When's the last time you bought a Tom's, Jordan?
Truly in 2014.
Wow.
That's a long time.
This is like your story. This totally makes sense. It's amazing.
All right. Well done. Well done. Jordan, we're so glad we were able to catch up with you because Tom's is the company. Tim is my co-host. Tim and I have been talking about this one. Jordan Holman, she's a retail reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone from Atlanta. When's the last time you bought them?
I have never owned them, but my wife used to wear them. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Yep. They were everywhere.
But on that trip to Austin a few years ago, I went into the Tom's store. So yeah, bring it all back.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, it is time for the Drive to the Close, and great to have back with us is Eric Jackson, founder, president of the Toronto-based hedge fund EMJ Capital, and he's on the phone in Toronto. Eric, it is good to have you back with us. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Carol?
Doing well, doing well. Just kind of managing my way through. You look at the environment, you look at what folks are saying about the economic bounce back and what it might mean for the financial markets. How do you see it?
Well, touch word, I think we seem to have come out of this six-week period from mid-February to the end of March where, you know, it was a real shake the trees moment, especially for tech, especially for growth tech, but for, you know, for the market overall. And even though, you know, these kinds of things, you know, they happened just before the election in October, they happened in the summer, they happened last May. Like, there's always like these moments of crisis, which you know, in the moment, seem like, you know, the world is ending, and people say, well, now it's obviously the time to get out of tech and move to value or move to financials or move
so
to oil,
true.
Whatever the argument is. It doesn't really, you know, at the end of the day, the moment passes. Great companies are great companies, and I think, you know, I focus on tech, obviously, and mm-hmm. my outlook for the rest of the year is I think there's some great buys at the moment in that world.
Eager to hear what you think some of those buys are. I mean, last year the big stories for you included Snowflake, they included Zillow. You saw those, according to a Bloomberg article, as next generation fangs. What are you watching in the second quarter of this year?
Well, my biggest position, and the, you know, the one that it's had a great run already, but I still see lots of runway ahead of it, not just for this year, but multiple years ahead, is a company called Upstart. It was a December IPO, and around the time when Airbnb was IPOing and DoorDash was IPOing, and that was all you ever heard about if you're turning to Bloomberg or whatever, this was kind of like a much more unheralded IPO, but you know, it was my favorite of last year. Came out at $20, and immediately, kind of in you know, the beginning of this year, went up, shot over $100. It's basically started a company that started by a bunch of ex Google engineers who decided they wanted to build a better version of the FICO score to predict credit risk using, you know, sort of Google-esque AI models, and they basically match consumers looking for personal loans to lenders, and they do a better job of predicting who's likely to default, who's likely to miss a payment. So it ends up, you know, costing everyone in the system less than the traditional matching process. They're not a bank. They're not taking on any credit risk themselves. They're just putting these folks together, and they've been doing so very successfully. And it's not for the faint of heart. During the whole tech meltdown, it had a 55% drawdown from like mid-February till kind of mid-March.
And you stuck with it?
But I stuck to my guns, and it had its first earnings report, and I think it was on St. Patrick's Day, and sort of surprised everyone on Wall Street because they guided to revenue growth this year of 114%, while the street was expecting something like 30-ish percent growth, and suddenly the stock shot from like 40 to now it's at like around 120, 130 bucks today. So it's because of this growth that people saw. What's most exciting about the story for me is that today they're just doing personal loans. So it's basically consumers looking to do refinance credit card debt. So that's the personal loan market. And they've got about a 5% share there. But they have moved into auto loans. And they expect to, within the next year or so, move into mortgages. And just those two markets, auto loans and mortgages, it's about 44 times the size of the personal loan market. So, building a better mousetrap, putting people together, lowering credit costs and so forth, it's a great model.
So how can they offer more competitive auto loans and mortgages than the big banks?
Basically, they can predict who's, Eric's likely to miss a payment, but Tim, is not as likely to miss a payment, even though, we might have similar, FICO scores. Mm-hmm. On a bunch of, traditional credit metrics, we might seem, the same risk to one of the big banks who often try to do all the modeling themselves in-house. Upstart typically working with smaller lenders, and they're doing a better job than the in-house, tech departments of these bigger banks. And their models are kind of doing the matching process better, so there are fewer defaults, fewer write-offs for these banks, and the consumers get to obtain lower interest rates on the loans that they get for the personal loan. So
Eric, it's kind of like a Tinder for like connecting banks, right? And banks and borrowers, because Upstart isn't actually carrying the loans on their balance sheet, correct?
No, they're not. Yeah, it is. It's a matchmaking service. They get paid a fee. But the nice thing about it is that the models work. And once it's kind of, they've set up, their relationship with the lenders, and they have a consumer-facing side to Upstart themselves to kind of get incoming demand. But once it's all set up, basically the models work. Everyone goes home at night, goes to sleep, but, people can get matched to the best loans that are out there for them. So,
right.
And then Upstart gets the fee for putting them all together.
So who buys them? Is it a JP Morgan that buys them? Is it like, does somebody buy them up or do they just continue to do it alone? Because it just seems like they would be ripe to be purchased.
I think the bigger banks will take longer to partner with an Upstart because they'll naturally have this bias, like, why can't we just do it ourselves?
Yeah.
We have these like thousands of people working at JP Morgan Chase. Why do we need to use these guys? I think they'll go after the smaller lenders first. Of course, they should be an acquisition target for any, not just the banks. I mean, I think, they would make a lot of sense for a Square or some bigger fintech player to look at them as well. But I think that they have a compelling business just on their own. I expect to hold this for like 5 years, and it's about a $9 billion market cap company today. But 5 years from now, I could easily see this surpassing $100 billion in market cap.
Hey, let's talk a little aviation because Bombardier is a company that you're also excited about. Not the Bombardier though from years ago, right? This is the Bombardier that is just focused on servicing and private flying.
Yeah, they make the subway car, or they did make the subway cars in New York City. They made the snowmobiles and the Sea-Doos and all this kind of stuff. They've sold all these businesses. They've had sort of like a tortuous 20-year odyssey, bad management. They've kind of sold off all these various businesses, and they're now just a pure play private jet seller. But because they've been so disappointing, they also have a lot of debt from all this kind of hangover of these bad deals. You know, I think people have forgotten about them. They're sort of seen as like, you know, wake me up when you guys actually do something type of thing. They're only trading at like $1 a share in Canada. There's a U.S. listing as well. What's exciting to me about them is that they have good management now in place. We're coming out of this pandemic period, and I think private jets are poised to kind of take off in popularity. I saw a stat today that we're actually back to 90% of the amount of private aircraft travel today compared to 2019, so pre-pandemic. Mm. Yet the fleets out there, the different private jets, are obviously older, so they need to be replaced. And I think what's exciting is that now, obviously, you know, the number of billionaires out there keep growing, but there's a whole new cast of folks who I think are going to increasingly look at doing private air travel in the years to come, even though we're all going to get back to flying on commercial jets, because coming out of the pandemic, people are just going to want that peace of mind. They're going to like the convenience. People have more money to spend on these things. So
right.
Whether it's with a net jet or owning their own plane, I think it's going to be a part of this reopening story, the private jet business. And Bombardier is interesting because it has sort of arguably the best, biggest, most luxurious aircraft out there, which is their Global Express 7500, which can travel nonstop from Singapore to Arizona. It's sort of like if you want to be the best of the best, it's one of the jets you will get, and it's extremely profitable for Bombardier too. So if they start to turn things around, if they start to pay down their debt. Remember how all the casinos coming out of the financial crisis were layered on with debt, but they actually ended up paying those down, refinancing them, and suddenly the equity value shot up in terms of what it was worth in the overall enterprise value. So
yeah.
I see a potential 20x return in Bombardier.
Yeah, looking at about $10.3 billion worth of debt right now, as you said. There's a bunch of debt on this company. But an interesting play, and it's got a market cap. I'm just looking at the ADRs here in the U.S. of about just under $2 billion. Eric, great conversation. Eric Jackson, founder president of EMJ Capital, joining us on the phone once again from Toronto.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.